Good morning and welcome to Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name's David Inge, and we're glad to have you listening. In December, it was announced that Southern Methodist University in Dallas had been chosen as a finalist for the site of the George W. Bush Presidential Library. Previously, there had been a short list of three universities as finalists, all of them in Texas. The other ones were Baylor in Waco and also University of Dallas at Irving. And perhaps not surprisingly, this announcement had generated some controversy there in Dallas and at SMU. Certainly, there were some members of the faculty who said publicly that they didn't want the Bush Library there and that they felt that it might tarnish the image of the institution to be host to the Bush Presidential Library. And all of this controversy started us thinking about the modern presidential library, where they come from, where and why they are built, who pays for them, who goes to them. And to seek some answers to these and perhaps other questions, we go to this morning's guest, Ben Hofbauer. He is a professor, associate professor of art history at the University of Louisville and is particularly interested in American art and architecture history. He is also the author of a book that was published in January of last year, January 2006, that explores this very subject. The title of his book is Presidential Temples: How Memorials and Libraries Shape Public Memory. It's published by the University Press of Kansas. And it takes a look at the development of the modern presidential library, the federal presidential library. The first one of those was built by and for Franklin Roosevelt. So now there are, I believe that there are 17 of them, or there will be 17 if and when the George W. Bush Library is built. People certainly over time have both praised these institutions and been critical. And he himself, in his book, says that it's certainly possible that these kinds of institutions can help us learn from our history. But he also writes in the book that if we give in to the worst impulses of presidents and their supporters, these libraries risk becoming temples of political propaganda. He's joining us this morning by telephone. As we talk, questions and comments are certainly welcome. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that is good anywhere that you can hear us, around Illinois, Indiana. In fact, if you were listening on the internet, as long as you're in the United States, you may use that toll-free line. That's 800-222-9455. So again, 333-WILL, toll-free 800-222-WILL or 9455. Those are the numbers to call. Professor Hofbauer, hello.
Hello. Thanks for having me.
Well, thank you very much for talking with us. We certainly do appreciate it. There are a lot of things that we could talk about, and I do want to talk a little bit about the history of these institutions. But just to get us going, I wonder, in a general sense, what's your reaction to the controversy there in Dallas over the choice of SMU to be the site for the library? What do you think about that?
Well, it's not surprising. These institutions are getting bigger and bigger, and some of the estimates for the Bush Library that it may cost as much as $500 million, which is quite a lot. This will be raised from private supporters. The controversy at SMU has kind of moved. Originally, there were some people who opposed the whole thing. Now, I think most professors agree that it would be okay to have the museum and the archive part of it. The big controversy is about the partisan institute.
Mm-hmm. The all sorts of questions come up with these kinds of institutions, and I guess that last point is an important one, and that is, one way or another, whatever kind of activities are undertaken here, whether they're scholarly or whether they are public, in the sense that there's what people think of when they think of these presidential libraries, I'm sure, is not so much the library component, but the kind of museum component that's attached to it, the thing that people go to visit, and I think that one way or another, there was a concern about the version of history that these places might present, and whether indeed they're institutions that are engaged in something that we might call spin.
Oh, yes, they're a lot about spin. Presidents, they love these institutions, and it probably won't surprise you to, when you think about presidents, their egos, I think, it's fair to say, are beyond what a normal person has or cannot really imagine. And they want to write their own history, if at all possible. And so the presidents serve kind of as the curators of their own museum. They kind of design the exhibits with the assistance of aides, of course, to tell their side of the story, which is not necessarily what a balanced historical account would say happened.
And this, I think this is an important point here. We're talking about the history of the presidential, the modern presidential library that we know today, that unlike perhaps other kinds of institutions that might honor or explore the memory of past presidents, the big difference here and the thing that started with Franklin Roosevelt is these were institutions that were built when that man was still alive and with his involvement. So it's a different thing from other kinds. I think you really make the point in the book. It's a very different thing from other kinds of presidential memorials that we have made. When we have made a memorial to someone, this is in many ways, in a real sense, it is someone commissioning and shepherding the construction of a memorial to himself.
Yes, you make a great point. I mean, in the past, when a president like Washington or Lincoln died, it would often take a few generations for us to build the Washington Monument or the Lincoln Memorial. It would take a lot of time for people to come to the conclusion, well, this person really needs a large monument. And now the presidents, whether they're good or bad or great or small, each one of them seems to get a very large and growing, they grow with time, monument to themselves that they design. And so that is a big change. And it does, one of the points I make in my book is it's a little bit like the ancient Egyptians or the Romans. The Romans had something called the imperial cult, where each emperor was kind of deified and made into a bit of a god, and they would have temples and shrines to them that were erected by the emperors and the empire. And I think presidential libraries in some ways are a little bit like that.
Mm-hmm. And I think, too, you make an important point that the rise of the presidential library and its growth in a very literal sense, because if you take a look at the buildings themselves and you compare the size and the cost of the Roosevelt Library with the most recent, with the Clinton Library, you can see that indeed they have grown literally in terms of square footage and in terms of the amount of money that it costs to build these things. But that growth has paralleled the growth in the power of the presidency.
Yes, definitely. There's a famous book by a historian named Arthur Schlesinger Jr., and I'm sure you've heard of it, called The Imperial Presidency. Mm-hmm. And Schlesinger basically makes a case that I think most historians and political scientists buy, that starting with Roosevelt, the power of the presidency really grew. And sometimes that could be considered a very good development, helpful for the nation and for the international affairs as well. But there have also been problems, obviously, Watergate, Vietnam, overreaches of presidential power. And I think in general, what you're saying is exactly right, that as these presidential libraries have grown, they're reflecting this growth in presidential power.
The Roosevelt Library, the Franklin Roosevelt Library, was completed in 1940, so that was several years before he passed.
Right.
Can you just talk a little bit about what it's like?
Well, it's a very charming little place compared to how grandiose the later presidential libraries are. It looks almost just kind of like a large home, a mansion. It's fieldstone. It's right near his family estate and mansion. And it's in New York in Hyde Park, kind of a rural area, beautiful site. And it really was kind of a revolution. They had a lot of good features, a lot of good reasons for establishing the presidential library. As I say in my book, presidents had owned their papers, and a lot of bad things had happened to them. Rats had eaten some of Washington's papers. There were restrictions on Lincoln's papers until 1947. And Roosevelt sold his library, saying, listen, I'll keep all my papers together here. They'll be run by the National Archives, and they'll be released to historians. And the story is kind of complicated, but basically that's what happened. Within 5 years after he died, by 1950, 70 or more percent of his papers were opened, and people could write and learn from our history much better than they had in the past.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure that some people would make the argument that it would make more sense for all of these presidential papers to be in some sort of central location, to be in Washington, D.C., in the Library of Congress, that they should all be together in one place so that scholars would have easy access to those sorts of things. Over the years, have people made that argument that says, you know, it doesn't make sense for them to be in Texas and in Arkansas and in Michigan and in California and that all scattered in all of these various places?
Yes, that argument's been made from the beginning. And a lot of when Roosevelt was trying to sell his presidential library, the first federal presidential library, he ran into a lot of opposition. And historians themselves said, well, why don't you just put your papers in the National Archives? And Roosevelt said, well, I really want to keep these collections together, not spread them into the different parts of the archive and not have people who don't know these collections, but to really keep them as a core that will be opened. I think you can make arguments on both sides of it, that it's a little bit of a waste and extravagance to have all these sites out there and that, well, maybe it's not such a good idea to have them all concentrated in one place.
Mm-hmm. In a sense, we've already made this point, but I think, again, it's worth making the point that if you look at, you make some comparisons between this very first library, the one that was built for and by Franklin Roosevelt, and then the more recent libraries, those of President Clinton and the president's father and so forth, that over time, perhaps the function has changed, or an additional function, a more public function has been added. So we're really going beyond the idea that this is just a place where we preserve the presidential papers so they're not eaten by rats.
Right.
We've gone into a completely different realm from that.
Definitely, they're huge and glitzy, beautiful buildings. Some of them, but yes, they have. Glitzy history museums with interactive exhibits. Some of them are very good, some not so good, and we could talk about that. And they have whole schools of public affairs and the controversy surrounding the Bush Partisan Institute that they've become much more than they originally were. The Roosevelt Library, as I said, is kind of a homey institution. It would cost $400,000 back in 1940, and that would be a lot more today, but maybe $8, $10 million. And Clinton's library, in contrast, cost $160 million, and the Bush library might be $500 million. So, yes, they've just grown enormously.
Yeah. Let me introduce again our guest for this hour, Ben Hofbauer. He is a specialist in American art and architectural history. He is associate professor of art history at the University of Louisville and has authored a book on this very subject. So if you're interested in reading more, you can look for the book. It's been out now just about a year. The title is Presidential Temples, How Memorials and Libraries Shape Public Memory, and it's published by the University Press of Kansas. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free, 800-222-9455. Well, since you just mentioned it, let's talk a little bit about the more public side of these institutions, because, as I said, I think probably when people talk about visiting them, they're not visiting the library per se. They're not going to the place perhaps where scholars go, or for people who go to attend symposia. They're going to the part that's open to the public, that looks at that person, his performance in the job, what were the big challenges facing the country at the time, and how well he met them. That's part of the idea. If you look at the public exhibits and the version of history that they present, can we say that they're good history, or are they sometimes questionable history?
Good point. Yeah, 99% of visitors to presidential libraries are there for the museum, as you said. Although actually anyone can go to the archives, any person. You don't have to be a scholar. You don't have to be a journalist. Any person with a legitimate research interest can walk in and use these archives. They're for the public. The public can use them as well. But yeah, 99% go for the museums. And most of them are museums of spin. They're the president's view of what they did. And so some of them are quite bizarre in that. For instance, when the Johnson Library opened in 1971, it said almost nothing about the Vietnam War, which was raging at the time, and there were protests while the library and museum were opened. The Reagan Library in Simi Valley, California, the biggest scandal, of course, during Reagan's presidency was the Iran-Contra scandal. and a serious scandal. A huge number of documents relating to it are in the Reagan Library Archive, but there's no mention of it in the museum. So yes, they're often very twisted, kind of propagandistic views of history. Now, this does change over time. For instance, in the Johnson Library, as I said originally, no mention of Vietnam. Today, if you go all these years later, you will find good exhibits on Vietnam, a more balanced approach to history. As time passes, as the decades pass, and the power of the president and his supporters wanes, and as the president dies, eventually better exhibits take hold. But sometimes it can take 30, 40, 50 years for that to happen.
You talked about the fact that, if you go back and as your kind of your starting point of reference, you look at the Roosevelt Presidential Library, and that perhaps in today's money that might have cost as much as, I don't know, $10 million maybe, that much, and maybe not that much. And if you take a look at now, what is the going rate to build one of these institutions? We're talking now about hundreds of millions of dollars, and I'm sure that every time a new one is built, it costs more than the last one. Who pays for these? Where does the money come from?
That's a great question. It's privately raised. It comes from the president's supporters, and Roosevelt sold the whole package of the presidential library on that basis, that, look, I'll raise the money privately to build this nice building, and then I'll hand it over for free to the federal government. And that may be a good system, but it does have some problems, especially as the fundraising needs have grown. And for the current President Bush, if he raises between $200 and $500 million for it, he's going to be raising it from his supporters. And unlike campaign contributions, which, as you know, are they're regulated, there's disclosure requirements, there's no regulation at all of these. So he can raise money from rich individuals, from even foreign governments, and there's no need to report it. And there's the potential for a president, obviously, to be influenced. If some government gives him $10 million for his presidential library, they might gain an audience with him and gain his ear for a little while for that $10 million, and we might never know about it. So there are many reforms that I feel need to be done for the good of the presidential library system to make these things really function in the public interest. But one thing is to look at the potential for corruption of the political process by at least disclosing who these donors are, who the people are who donate to these libraries, and what the amounts are.
Yeah, and so just to underline that point, right now it's completely closed. We don't know who has given money for the construction of the libraries. We don't know how much they've given.
Exactly, and that's potentially alarming. Usually when the libraries open, they have, like many museums and other places have, they'll have a big plaque saying, our gold level of donors are so on. But if Saudi Arabia, for instance, gave to the Bush Library and didn't want that disclosed, didn't think it'd be good publicity, they could say, we'd prefer not to be on the wall, or don't mention the amount, or something. Many presidential libraries do have donor walls, but they don't tell you the amount, and anyone who wants to be left out can be left out.
Mm. We now here in the state of Illinois, in Springfield, in the state capital, have a Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum. Now, admittedly, this is a different kind of thing that we're talking about, but I raise the issue because one of the arguments that was made in favor of building this in Springfield was that it would be a tourist destination. It would be another reason, and certainly there are a lot of historic sites in Springfield, and people go there because there are all these things there that have importance in the life of Abraham Lincoln. But I'm sure that a lot of people said, well, not only this would be a great center for scholars, but it not only did it make sense for this to be in Illinois, the land of Lincoln, but some people said that, this would also be a great thing for the city of Springfield, that people would go to the museum, and apparently that indeed has happened. Is it the case with some of these other institutions, the Johnson Library, the Clinton Library, the Ford Library, the Carter, the Nixon, all of these places, have they turned out to be good for tourism and for the local economies where they are?
The short answer is yes, they have been, but that changes over time. Often when a library first opens, there's huge interest in the first few years, but then that slowly over time declines. So, for instance, the Truman Library, back in the 60s and 70s would usually draw about 250,000 visitors a year, which is a great number for something out of the way in Independence, Missouri. And now it's more like 150,000 or 125,000. So it kind of declines over time, even for famous presidents. With the Clinton Library, there was a huge impact. He decided to build it in a rather depressed part of Little Rock, mostly abandoned warehouses and so on. Once he chose the site, there was an immediate effect in terms of property values, a lot of new construction. It sparked a $1 billion surge in private investment. They forecast, some people thought it was optimistic, that it would draw 300,000, 400,000 visitors. In fact, its first year it drew 500,000, 500,000 visitors, becoming suddenly the most popular presidential library in the whole system. So yeah, they can have a big impact, but it is something that over time, it declines and fades as these presidents get further back in history.
Mm-hmm. We talked about the fact that these institutions are built with private money, but they're also operated by the federal government. So, indeed, some federal taxpayer support does go into these institutions. How much, public money does one way or another go to support them?
I don't have the exact figure off the top of my head, but I think it's in the range of $50 million a year for all the libraries. And they're actually, in terms of the National Archives system, there are just 11 libraries right now. Uh-huh. There are these other libraries like the Lincoln Library, not run by the federal government, might be run by local states and other institutions. But there are 11 libraries, and they altogether cost around $50 million. Each library costs somewhere, $3, $4, $5 million a year. So, yeah, the cost is substantial when you think about over time that we are supposed to operate these forever as taxpayers. The cost is obviously adds up over time. That $5 million a year, over the course of a century, and these things are supposed to remain forever, there's a $500 million. And so part of my argument is that, and the argument of many people both within and without outside of the presidential library system, is that for the taxpayers paying that money, we should make sure that these things operate in the public interest. We shouldn't just let presidents do whatever they want and make them into temples of political propaganda. We should make sure that the museums have good history, that the archives are open, and recently President Bush issued an executive order blocking access to some of the archives. So there are issues that the public has a right to wonder, what are they getting in return for their money?
Yeah. Well, that's, I guess when you put it that way, initially when you talked about the amount of money, I guess I thought to myself, well, in terms of what the federal government spends on various things, that's not a whole lot of money. But if you consider it over the long term, then you are talking about some significant money. And I guess I hadn't really thought about the very last point that you make there, that the idea is that once one of these libraries is opened, that it will be open forever.
Yeah. Roosevelt wanted it. He specifically said when he invented the first federal presidential library, he said, "I want it in the legislation that the federal government for all time, as long as it exists, so as long as the United States remains in existence, that this building will be staffed and operated and well-maintained." And he got that in the legislation. And some people, when he was doing it, called him an egocentric megalomaniac for wanting that, but he got it in there, and that's part of it. Once these are accepted by the federal government, they are supposed to, who knows what will actually happen, but they're supposed to remain forever for all time as long as the United States remains in existence.
Yeah. Let me ask you just one more question, and I have a caller here we'll get to, and certainly other folks who are listening are welcome to call. Given some of the questions that we have raised about these libraries, and given the fact that it seems that over time they have become bigger and bigger and been more and more expensive, do you think that we should expect that into the future will continue to have them, or would it be at some point, and I suppose this would be up to the president himself or herself, to say, I think we should do something different. Is that what it would take for us to come to the point where we said, well, maybe that doesn't really make any sense to build these institutions as we have been building them?
It could happen, yeah. Just as Roosevelt was the first to say, "I want one of these things," it's possible that some president in the future will just say, "I don't need it," and they could just turn over their papers to the National Archives and forget it. The odds that a president would give up, though, on this is the presidential library is a great tool in what I call the final campaign. It's after they're no longer running for re-election by the voters exactly, but they're running for the re-election of history to try to be noted as one of the great or at least good presidents in history, and they want that tool to be operating, you know, even after they're gone to do that. So they. A president would have to have a smaller ego than your average president has had so far for that to happen.
Our guest in this hour of Focus 580 is Benjamin Huffbauer. He is Associate Professor of Art History at the University of Louisville. He's interested in specialist in American art and architectural history. He is the author of a book that explores this subject. And so if you would like to read more, you look for the book. It was published in January of 2006. The book is Presidential Temples, How Memorials and Libraries Shape Public Memory. That's the subtitle. It's published by University Press of Kansas. We have a caller. Others would be welcome to call in with questions and comments. 333-9455 for Champaign-Urbana, toll-free 800-222-9455. Our first caller here is in Urbana, line one. Hello.
Yeah, good morning. Mm-hmm. I have just recently started using the Presidential Library over there in Springfield, and I find it has a tremendous resource, you know, for the amateur genealogist. And I was just wondering, I mean, I wasn't expecting that, but it's a great library, you know, if you're interested in tracing your family history. Is the Presidential Library there in Springfield kind of unique in that aspect?
I don't know that much about the Lincoln Library. I was there right when they were building it. But yeah, I think it is kind of unique. Presidential libraries often, as they age, they get interesting collections of papers, all sorts of things, and it varies by library. Some things aren't directly connected to the president. But probably the Lincoln Library is somewhat unique in that.
Yeah, okay. Thank you very much.
All right. Other questions, again, are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. I ask you to talk a little bit about and maybe give a little bit of a description of the Roosevelt Library, which is the first one. And again, I guess I want to make sure people understand what we're talking about here is the modern presidential library as an institution that we've come to know it. And by that we mean that these libraries that were planned, that were dedicated when the president was still alive, and where the president actually had some say in what the place was like. So the first one of those is the Roosevelt Library, and that came into being in 1940 or 41. Tell us a little bit about one of the more recent ones as a way of making some comparison, either, you know, say, for example, the Johnson Library.
Well, the Johnson Library is a great example because it really took the whole presidential library to the next level. They were growing. The first one was for Roosevelt, and then there was Truman and Eisenhower, and each of them grew bigger. But they were built in the small towns where these presidents were raised, Abilene, Kansas, and Independence, Missouri. And when Johnson became president, he said, I want to have the best presidential library ever. And he had a great partner to make this happen, Lady Bird Johnson, who he assigned, and she kind of assigned herself, to go out and try to find the best architect she could find and the best place to do it and try to build the best presidential library that she could build. They ended up hiring an architect named Gordon Bunshaft, who was a quite well-known architect, part of the famous firm of Skidmore, Owings, and Merrill. And they built a huge library, 85 feet tall, with beautiful Italian travertine marble. It looks kind of like a cross between a bureaucracy and an Egyptian pylon temple out there at the campus of the University of Texas at Austin. And so it's huge. It's massive, beautiful architecture. It also has a School of Public Affairs. And the creation of that library really took the whole institution to an entirely new level, just kind of like the Bush Library most likely may do that soon. But the $500 million will be far more than anyone has ever spent. This one took it to that next level and had an interesting personal apartment for Johnson himself as part of the complex.
That's a really interesting story, and I'd like to hear more about that because that doesn't seem to me to be. I wouldn't think, you know, among the various things that these libraries would do and would have, the idea that the former president, if he wanted, could stop by and have a shower. That's not the kind of thing that I would think that they would be about. But in fact, there, that place, that was the case.
Yes. Well, there's a couple little stories that I have about the Johnson Library. Johnson happens to be one of the more amusing characters in political history. One thing that that when they wanted to build the best presidential library ever, they were trying to take all the best features of the past libraries. And the Truman Library was the first to have a nearly full-scale Oval Office replica, 94% scale. And Lady Bird saw that this was the most popular exhibit. But when she talked to the architect, Gordon Bunshaft, he was a modernist architect. He didn't want a historical room. He said, I don't want that room in there. Well, you know, we don't need to have that. And she told that to President Johnson. And President Johnson finally phoned the architect from the Oval Office. And this phone call was recorded by Johnson's secret recording system. And so he calls this architect up at home, who's quite shocked to be called by the President of the United States, who says, essentially, I'm not quite getting it right, and I can't quite do the Texas accent, but Johnson says something like, I have a powerful fire desire for that office, and I want that Oval Office replica in there. Are you going to do it, Mr. Bunshaft? And he said, yes, sir, Mr. President, if that's what you want. It's there. So he put that in actually in place of his personal office, but he also, Gordon Bunshaft, built for him an elegant, extremely beautiful personal apartment with a shower, which is not part of the regular tour. I was only able to see it by special permission because I was writing about it. That is just beyond belief. For one, it has four shower heads. The amount of water pressure going through it was astonishing. This was similar to something that Johnson had installed in the White House. In addition, this shower has mirrors all around it. So Johnson, as he's being blasted with these four shower heads, can see the image of himself multiplied. To me, this was kind of an illustration of the marvelous narcissism that presidents can have, that you'd need a shower, mirrors all around, four shower heads. It's kind of an amusing story about Johnson and his ego. But the Clinton Library, apparently, probably no four shower heads, but it has quite a deluxe apartment there. I wasn't able to get to see that. I think it would be a long time before that'll be open to any researchers.
And have, in fact, the former presidents used these places? Did Lyndon Johnson go and take showers in his presidential library?
Yes, I think he did sometimes. I think he mainly spent time in his ranch. Mm-hmm. But they, in fact, had a specially constructed helicopter pad at the top of the building. So he wouldn't even have to come in the building the normal way. The helicopter could come and bring him down at the top. He could go to a special entrance into a secret apartment. It had a beautiful, incredibly beautiful room with Asian art in it. And he had a TV, a special Sony TV set up with the three TVs. He liked to watch three stations simultaneously. And then anytime he wanted to, if he wanted to relive his glory days in the Oval Office, he could, a few steps away from the shower, he could enter into the Oval Office replica. Someone described it to me as kind of like the Wizard of Oz coming behind the curtains to exist in his replica again. But obviously, the replica wasn't like the real Oval Office, and I think he may have found that a replica wasn't like the real thing.
Yeah. We have a couple of other callers here. Let's talk next with someone in Coles County on our line 4, the toll-free line. Hello.
Yes, I want to mention something quite important that a lot of people don't understand. That is that the Lincoln Library in Springfield includes the entire Illinois State Historical Library. Hmm. The Illinois State Historical Library used to be housed in the lower level of the old state capitol, which I think is pretty much across the street from the Lincoln Library, very close to it. So, and of course, the Illinois State Historical Library includes materials over nearly 200 years. I would suspect that, I'm just guessing on this, and they may deny this, but I would suspect there's more material about general Illinois history than about Lincoln in the Lincoln Library, and I think that's good. I'm not implying that that's bad, because there's just a vast amount of material on every county and every town in Illinois over 100, 200 years there. The Illinois State Historical Library was, pretty good size. And, of course, it includes newspaper microfilm from throughout the state and all that kind of thing. So a very large component of the Lincoln Library is the Illinois State Historical Library, much of which is not directly related to Lincoln. Okay.
Yeah,
I think that's
a good point. And again, I think we want to draw the distinction between an institution like that, like the Lincoln Library that's in Springfield, and the museum that's associated with it, and the kind of presidential libraries where, that we have been talking about here. There's a really two different kinds of things. Let's go. I appreciate the comments of the call. Let's go on to somebody else. Paxton is next. Line one. Hello.
Yeah. Hi, David. A very interesting show. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Just two quick questions, and since I'm on a cell, I'll go ahead and ring off. You were mentioning it about Johnson, and I would urge anybody who could get their hands on the audio tapes. Johnson was quite a colorful president, and he didn't mince words, and some of the stuff was a little salty, but the audio tapes of Johnson, they were just fascinating. And I was wondering, my first question was, in these presidential libraries, are audio tapes of the presidents available for people to listen to and take out? And then my second question is, some of the more obscure presidents, I'm just wondering if there's a trend with presidential libraries. In other words, I don't expect anytime soon to have a Millard Fillmore presidential library. but I'm just wondering, some of the more obscure presidents, I'm guessing people would have to go probably to the archives for their papers or what have you, and wonder if you could comment on that, and I'll go ahead and ring off. Thanks.
All right. Thank you.
Okay. Well, the caller's right. The audio tapes for the Johnson Library are absolutely fascinating. And yes, they are available. They're available for researchers. But as I said, these archives, you know, the papers of the president, they're owned by the American people at this point. And you don't have to be a researcher, someone writing a book or a newspaper article to go in. The public can make appointments, and you know, you have to follow all their rules and procedures, but you can go in and listen to these audio tapes. In fact, many of the websites for the Johnson Library website, if you go to that, you'll find audio tapes online. And yes, Johnson was amazing in the things he said and his political knowledge and the both the triumphs and the tragedies of his political life. You can hear it pretty raw there. So, yes, those are there in terms of obscure presidents. What's interesting is that there are more and more, obviously, Lincoln, you know, one of the maybe the most important president in U.S. history and certainly deserving of a museum and so on. But many of them, more obscure, not deserving of it, their papers would be in the National Archives. But some for even somewhat more obscure presidents, but still significant, like Woodrow Wilson, they've started to begin to develop museums and libraries that are not part of the National Archives, but are just more private institutions.
We have about 10 minutes left in this part of Focus 580. Again, our guest is Ben Huffbauer. He is Associate Professor of Art History at the University of Louisville and is interested in American art and architectural history and is author of a book, Presidential Temples, How Memorials and Libraries Shape Public Memory. It was published in January of 2006 and takes a look at the growth of the modern presidential library as we know it today, as we have come to know it, beginning with the one that was built by Franklin Roosevelt in the early 1940s and continues to this day to be open, as all of the libraries that have been open since continue to be open. Questions here are welcome. 333-9455, toll free 800-222-9455. At the beginning, I mentioned some of the controversy and some of the debate that's going on now in Dallas with the announcement a couple of months ago that SMU, Southern Methodist University, had been selected as the site for the George W. Bush Library. And the fact that a lot of people on the campus there are not particularly happy about it, and one of the things that they're concerned with, they're concerned with a number of things. They're concerned with the fact that there would be associated with it a clearly partisan kind of political institute. And I think that also they have raised questions about the Bush administration's enthusiasm for keeping things secret. And that's really not in the spirit of historical scholarship, and that things really ought to be open to, so that the record can be examined by scholars, by anybody who wants to. How many? I'm curious about how many of these institutions are in fact affiliated with universities, and whether people at the university have the opportunity to have some oversight or some role in how these places are constructed and how it is that they are run?
Well, starting with Johnson, many of them have been associated with universities, but not all. Johnson and Kennedy, Bush 1, Clinton, In terms of how the archive functions and how the museum functions, the universities have very little or almost no role. I think that could be, especially in terms of how the museums work, I think it would be a great benefit if they could get, for instance, the historians and political scientists at SMU to help work on the George Bush Museum to create a nonpartisan, balanced history of the era rather than an extended campaign commercial. But right now, they don't have much power. I think that's one of the reforms that could be made, is to require that these institutions get a group of qualified historians to review and help develop the exhibits.
Hmm. Not very long ago, I had a conversation with the author of a book about art controversies in America, controversies over public art. Some of the people will think about some of the recent ones that have been very controversial. But what's interesting is that if you go back in history, first of all, the idea of controversy over public art is not new. And the second thing is that actually, if you go back and you look at some of the big controversies, they were in fact about big public memorials, and some of them presidential memorials. For example, there apparently at the time that the Washington Monument was proposed, there was great controversy, first of all, about whether it should be built at all. And about what it should look like, and that some of these now places that are much cherished and admired and visited in Washington, D.C., places like the Jefferson Memorial and the Lincoln Memorial, there was a lot of argument at the time about should they be built and what should they look like and where were they going to go. And I think it's interesting to think, as you do, to raise some questions about, well, how it is we in what ways we do memorialize presidents, and about how perhaps there has been a significant change in the way that we do that.
Yeah, there certainly has been controversy. It took a long time. It took 50, 60 years to build the Washington Monument, and for a time, it's a long story and I won't get into it, but the Know-Nothing stole the stone and the thing wasn't finished at the outbreak of the Civil War, and it was kind of a symbol of the nation being unfinished, unable to resolve it. So scandal's not new for presidential libraries. One point I'd like to touch on just briefly, if I could, is these libraries really can be made to operate more in the public interest. At the Truman Library, the director there in the 1990s, a man named Larry Hackman, decided he really wanted to make the presidential library more interesting, to do real history in the museum, not just a campaign commercial, to get a good education program for middle and high school students. And so for people who say, oh, you just can't expect anything but propaganda from these things, what Larry Hackman and many other talented people at the Truman Library did proves that's wrong. They consulted with historians. They developed very interesting and serious exhibits that dealt with issues that the Smithsonian couldn't even deal with. It's a long way back, but I don't know if you remember, about 12 years ago, the Enola Gay plane that dropped the bomb was displayed at the Smithsonian. They had all sorts of arguments about how do we tell the story of World War II, and they couldn't do it. So they just canceled the exhibit entirely and just showed the plane with nothing, just saying this is the plane that dropped the bomb. Well, the Truman Library deals with this very issue that the Smithsonian couldn't, and they look at both sides of it. They're not trying to convince you one way or the other. They're just trying to show you these were the tough historical realities that people faced, whether they were using conventional weapons or nuclear weapons, and showing voices on both sides. People like Dwight Eisenhower, the great World War II hero, said that he didn't think that dropping the atomic bombs on Japan was a good idea. In addition, of course, to many veterans who saw it saved their lives and ended the war, but also the reality that many civilians were killed in the attacks. It just shows you the complexity of history, and viewers really engage with that and have reactions to it, and it provides a place for people to give responses. The second thing that the Truman Library did, which is neat, which I don't know if we have time to talk about, is the White House Decision Center.
Sure, go ahead.
The Truman Library built in its basement basically a replica of the West Wing. It's kind of like the West Wing TV program. They've got parts of a cabinet room, other things. And basically they bring in middle and high school students to play the roles of President Truman, his cabinet, his advisors, and young women can play the role of Harry Truman, Harriet Truman, and they deal with different historical crises like the Berlin airlift, desegregation in the military, other things. And then they have to do a press conference and look at historical documents about military crises and other things. Anyway, students love this program. They have great fun. It's like playing West Wing. And it has real historical content. and doesn't shy away from controversial issues. Most presidential libraries, not all, but most of them, don't really have effective educational programs, so they're just kind of more of the propaganda, look at this great president or something. The Truman Program really has serious history, both in the museum and in the educational component, showing that presidential libraries really can be made to operate in the public interest if we just, you know, get ourselves together and try to make it work.
Yeah. Just, you know, I'm curious to go back for a moment to the decision when the Truman Library was being planned and built to put this replica of the Oval Office in there. Mm-hmm. You also talked about the fact that LBJ came along afterwards. He was building his library, and he decided he also needed to have a replica of the Oval Office. I suppose I could understand the particularly at that time when the Truman Library was built, the interest in people to know what it might look like, what it might feel like, who are never going to get to go to the actual Oval Office.
Mm-hmm.
So I can understand that from a tourist point of view, that would be interesting. What was behind the thinking of having, was this in fact Truman himself, was it his idea to have this replica of the Oval Office in his museum?
Yeah, I think it was largely his idea. It may have been some advisor who recommended it, but Truman latched onto it, and he knew the fascination and power of this room. The power of the presidency really started growing with Roosevelt. The Oval Office itself was only first built. It wasn't part of the original White House. It was only first built in 1909, was actually moved and remodeled during Roosevelt's presidency. And so the Oval Office is part of the American imagination of this is where the president could decide the fate of the world. Really, it gets going during Roosevelt's and Truman's presidencies. And so it's a reflection of the increase in presidential power that's occurring at the time.
You know, what's also interesting about these museums is that they're not just about the president. They also have at least some component of the rest of the president's life, and part of that is the first lady. So that is how it is that we get into these displays of dresses that mm-hmm. these various women wore. Is having something like that part of the business? An effort to, in a sense, humanize the man in the institution by showing that there was this other facet to his life, and he did, in fact, have this partner. And we certainly know that these women, many of them were very, very important in terms of supporting their husbands and in helping them think about what it is they were going to do.
Yeah, exactly so. It does humanize, and the exhibits of dresses, which are also found at the Smithsonian, or they recently closed for the Smithsonian for remodeling, but are incredibly popular. But it does, first ladies, as you say, have often played a crucial and hidden and sometimes behind-the-scenes role in getting presidents elected and in enacting certain policies. Lady Bird Johnson did the Highway Beautification Act. Each First Lady recently has had a cause that she has championed, and often quite successfully. And there is a great fascination with that. What's going to be interesting is at some point we're going to have, I think, a woman president, and both how that operates in national life in the White House, but also how it operates in the presidential library will be interesting as they have exhibits about the first man.
You think we'll have a mannequin there with wearing one of his suits?
I wonder, yeah, men's dress clothing doesn't seem quite as interesting for display. I wonder how they'll deal with that. I have no idea.
Yeah. Returning to the controversy surrounding SMU, in spite of the fact that there seem to be some people there on the faculty at SMU that aren't really all that happy about the idea, certainly that and the other universities who were on their short list did make a strong pitch. And I'm sure that there are a lot of people there in Dallas and at Southern Methodist that would be just perfectly happy, would be thrilled to have the Bush Library there on their campus. I'm assuming that the fact that there is some local opposition is not likely to get in the way of having the library there?
It's hard to say. My guess is you're exactly right, that it's likely to end up at SMU. I think the big question is whether the institute could be modified. In the past, like the Carter Center, which you know is a big, pretty famous philanthropic organization, that's mm-hmm. nonpartisan. The big thing is that this is partisan, and the question is whether the institute could maybe be located off campus, or whether it could be made nonpartisan. It may not, maybe none of those changes will be made, and it will go exactly as is. But I think that there's a faculty vote coming up, and that may may slightly change the shape of the debate. But yeah, I think you're right. It's likely to end up at SMU and be the biggest, most expensive presidential library ever built.
Yeah. Given, you know, we talked about the idea that part of this story is a change in perhaps the way we honor presidents, or at least from publicly funded, planned memorials to ones that are, in a sense, privately planned and funded, and something where the president himself says, this is what I want for me. This is going to be a physical manifestation of my legacy. And, you know, like LBJ, they say, I want a big, rugged, masculine kind of building because that's,
right.
the, kind of, that's the kind of guy I am. Will we ever again, I'm not sure when the last time there was a kind of a public memorial on the level of, say, the Lincoln Memorial or the Washington Monument that was built.
Well, they kind of tried. I don't think it had the same impact. But Roosevelt, they finally built a Roosevelt, an FDR memorial in Washington, D.C. It's a little bit out of the way. It's a fairly big and expensive thing, and it almost looks like a museum in stone. I wonder almost if the presidential libraries had an influence. It has kind of different rooms in stone based on each of his terms in office. But yeah, it seems to some degree that unless it's an extraordinary president like Roosevelt, that the presidential library has replaced the traditional presidential memorial.
Yeah, the one you talk about is this is the place where they have the sculpture of the president sitting in his wheelchair with Fala sitting
exactly,
nearby.
Exactly. Yeah.
That's interesting, and I'm not exactly sure what that says about the way that we think about the president. The fact that I'm sure, for example, there were people who would think that there ought to be a monument in Washington D.C. to Ronald Reagan, but whether such a thing, even with somebody like that, who would have a lot of supporters, where there would be interest, where I'm sure there would be people willing to pony up the money to build such a thing. Whether even in a case like that, it seems unlikely that we would ever see such a thing.
Yeah, I think the official rules for monuments in Washington, D.C., you know, they've got so many monuments there that they've had to set rules. And they said you can't even start to build a monument until 20 years after they died. And we would look at, I guess, 2024 for Ronald Reagan. And if at that time they still want to memorialize him, they'll start it. But presidents don't want to wait that long. They don't want to wait till after they're dead. They want to do it right now.
Well, again, if folks who are listening are interested in reading on this subject, you can look for the book that we have mentioned. The title of the book is Presidential Temples, How Memorials and Libraries Shape Public Memory. It was published in January of last year by the University Press of Kansas by our guest, Ben Huffbauer. He is Associate Professor of Art History at the University of Louisville. Thanks very much for talking with us.
Thanks, David. It's a pleasure to talk to you.